Hello and welcome to Rapids Fire, the Accelerated Data Science Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Mahler. This is going to be the first bonus episode of Rapids Fire, where we go a little bit off of our main topic of talking about advances in day-to-day data science and artificial intelligence. And we're going to talk about something that I've seen in movies and depicted in fiction my whole life, that friends and acquaintances that do not work in the field are terrified of. And I'm going to talk to an expert about brains. That is my guest today, Rachel Allen, senior cybersecurity data scientist at NVIDIA. Thank you for joining me, Rachel.
Thanks so much for having me, Paul.
So, Rachel, to begin with, your PhD, could you tell us what that was and give us a little bit more insight into the research that ended up being your doctoral thesis?
So I recorded from different brain regions to see how olfactory stimuli are represented inside the brain as my doctoral thesis. And then as my postdoc, I moved to the visual system where I played different visual stimuli and recorded from individual neurons in the brain to see how they responded and how, you know, the external world is encoded by different brain regions.
It must have been really interesting research. I know that, at least for me personally, a particular smell will like take me back to a place where I lived in grad school. Can you tell us what kind of mathematical techniques you used? And I ask this because I first became aware of lasso regression. It's not something economists use very often. I was trained as an economist, but I became aware of lasso regression when I had read a paper that somebody had used lasso regression to kind of reconstruct from brain scans what the person was looking at. And lasso regression is kind of a bread and butter introductory data science technique. So what kind of techniques were you using?
Sure. So I did a lot of signal processing. I was using mouse models. So I did actual like single cell recording. And so mathematically, it's a lot of correlations, Fourier transforms. Obviously, the visual stimuli comes in like different frequencies. You're going to need to correlate those with the activity.
Did you ever see the tongue-in-cheek paper that showed neural activity in a dead salmon? It was meant to, I think, be a parody of the abuse of over-reliance on covariance. I just like it that I had people in my life at the time that that came out that thought it proved the afterlife for animals.
Yeah, I do. I remember that paper was a long time ago. I think there's a lot of criticism of fMRI activity, which is, you know, how you're going to measure a lot of activity in the human brain, where you can't be as invasive as I was, where I was actually sticking electrodes in single cells. And I think, you know, the math to do the comparisons of the blood flow of different brain regions is really difficult and sometimes gives these like spurious correlations and can show that, you know, there's activity in something that's not alive. I would say that is definitely not proof of the afterlife.
In some ways, in kind of like a reverse process, a lot of the breakthroughs, I mean, particularly your great work on Cybert, had its origins in like the 1950s, where somebody took a model of the brain and used it to inspire a mathematical technique. I'm not the strongest deep learning expert, nor do I really have any meaningful understanding of how the brain works. How close are neural nets to the actual physical architecture of a simple brain?
Yeah, so I've thought about this a lot. So there's obviously the work kind of goes both ways, where there's biologists who want to model what they're actually seeing, you know, with like all of their lab techniques. They want to model all these neurons and they know they have the connectome. They know like how all these regions are connected, and they want to model all that. And then there's computer scientists that just really want to build, you know, like these intelligent systems. And the crossover is this functional unit of like the neuron or the perceptron, where it's essentially gets an input. It's connected to something that has an input and an output. And depending on like the summation of these inputs, whether it triggers this activation function is whether or not it sends an output further down the chain. So this like functional unit of neurons is fairly consistent, I guess, between the two fields. There's, you know, a million more complexities to human neurons than there are to artificial neurons. You know, human neurons can be electrically coupled or chemically coupled. There's ones that are always firing really fast. And, you know, there's this huge diversity of neurons, whereas in artificial neural networks, you get a lot of all the same type, but you just strengthen and weaken their connections to each other, which is super similar to the human brain when it's learning something too.
Interesting. So I guess if somebody much more mathematically gifted than me was able to represent those different classes of neural interaction, do you think that would be a big leap forward in the models? Or do you think that we should just keep making bigger and bigger models based on what we have now? I mean, I'm sure your answer isn't going to be that we shouldn't continue to push on research, but I'm curious to think, just as like a gut feeling, do you think that that would make a big difference?
Yeah, I think the bigger and bigger models have seem effective in some ways, especially when you train them on like the entire internet amount of information. These huge, huge models, even though the diversity of neurons isn't very large, they're still able to learn from just this huge, huge corpus. So there's strength in the size of your model for sure. But I think as you're moving towards more like generalizable kind of tasks, if you want more of that, then you could probably get away with a smaller model and more resilient, more robust learning and output if you had just more types of neurons inside of your network.
That's really interesting. What we've been dancing around and what people, especially people that I know that don't work in computer science or data science or aren't even adjacent to it, is the question of what is now called artificial general intelligence. Artificial intelligence isn't good enough anymore because a first-year consultant doing linear regression in Excel is calling that artificial intelligence, which is certainly not self-aware. I hope not. But we're talking essentially about conscious machines. And for our listeners, that my background prior to becoming an economist was in philosophy. So I approached consciousness from a different angle, perhaps, than the biological sciences does. When you think of consciousness, what's your definition of it?
I would say it's the experience of something. It's this hard problem to define consciousness because I know I'm conscious because I'm experiencing it, but it's hard to empirically know that you're conscious without that experience.
Yeah, I'm only aware of my own consciousness and I just have to trust everybody around me to be conscious. I'm going to link in the episode description to a comic strip by an author I really like that exclusively writes comics about philosophy that makes fun of one particular view. But that's a view that I think is going to be particularly interesting to our audience. I'm going to probably flub this and people can let me know on Twitter, but the Turing test more or less says that a machine that can trick people into believing that it's conscious has consciousness. When we were talking ahead of the episode, you talked about a continuum of consciousness. And one of the examples you used was dogs. I will tell you that I've recently quit eating all cephalopods. So I loved calamari. I loved octopus at sushi restaurants. But based on research about how smart they are now out of my diet. Tell us a little bit about how you conceive of a continuum of consciousness.
You know, what makes humans really unique is that we have language to talk about our consciousness. But, you know, I have a son and, you know, and as a newborn, he obviously couldn't tell me that he was conscious, but he was on many levels, right? And I would say pets have some level of consciousness. And I think it's really interesting to bring up in this discussion, like, where do you draw the line? Octopus is such a great example, right? They can change colors. They can do all these really cool things that we aren't capable of doing, almost, you know, superhuman activities, but they haven't developed the ability to tell us that they're conscious. So is the criteria that you have to have language that humans can understand to be conscious? Because that doesn't seem fair. Because I think there's just lots of things that they show qualities of experiencing life. Obviously, a baby and a dog, you can watch their behavior and you can see that they are aware of their experiences. If you say that you have to tell me that you're conscious, then that leaves takes a lot off the table for things that seem conscious to me.
Certainly. I will also link to this in the episode description, but immediately prior to Christmas, I believe Nature published an article where researchers had observed octopi punching fish out of spite. So I would propose a new functionalist test where if you can see something being a jerk, because both dogs and babies can do stuff just to be a jerk, maybe that counts as consciousness. But do you think that we will have artificial general intelligence in our lifetimes?
There's two camps on this. One camp looks at the current state of things and says, we're so far from AGI. Like, look at all the limitations of everything we have. It's very narrow AI, very task specific, you know, and there's skeptics that we're not going to get there. And then the other camp is so excited about the velocity at which we're reaching these new milestones of things that AI can do. And those people are more confident that in our lifetimes, we'll definitely get there because the velocity is so fast. And I find myself mostly in the latter, where, yeah, we have a lot to overcome before we get there. But I think the speed at which we're moving is super promising. I also don't think that you necessarily need consciousness for AGI. I think there's a separation between intelligence and consciousness, even though it's hard for us as humans to really feel that difference.
I agree. I think the question, one of the things that anybody that begins thinking about this would ask is like the question of self-awareness. But prior to recording our podcast today, GarageBand yelled at me when I unplugged the microphone as I was walking my computer to where I do my recording. So my MacBook Pro right now has a certain level of self-awareness in terms of the peripherals that are connected to it. Anybody would say that that's laughable in terms of like artificial general intelligence, but I think it's a good illustration about how difficult some of these things are to define in a satisfying way.
I think it's also human nature to like anthropomorphize everything. People give their Roombas names and swear they have personalities of their own. And I'm sure the Roombas 10 years from now will even seem even more conscious and aware.
Some of the things that you'd brought up before we started recording were, you know, general questions about what's missing in the design of deep learning models right now in terms of getting us there. We mentioned really large models like GPT-3, and this also ties back to what you told me about brains in general, is that a brain is never fully at rest. It's always doing something. And these large models are still glorified equations to some points. So you said that, you know, GPT-3 won't accidentally become conscious because they're large and complex. I remember a lot of friends in a panic when there was a report that there was some intermediary language that Google Translate had developed. I was like, no, that's just a function. The machine didn't develop its own language. Could I have some of your thoughts around those issues?
I think there's a couple issues in there. I'd love to talk about how your friends are confused by how people are explaining things other people are doing with AI. I think that's a huge problem and kind of feeds into this fear that these models that we're building are doing things that we don't know about. That's not true. There's no accidental learning happening amongst these things. I think, you know, with these large language models, we are kind of impressed by their outputs and their function, but we know exactly like the goal of the training that's happening. And there's this new model that OpenAI put out earlier this week that can generate, you know, new images from text. But we have total control of the training data that it's using, even though it's very, very large, and it's outputting these images. And what's happening in the middle is accessible at, on some level. You know, it's these quote unquote neurons that I'm talking about. You can see what activates some neurons and not others. And you can look at representations of different inputs and things inside these models. So it's harder to communicate what these things are doing as they get larger and more complex. And there is like this interpretability problem that comes into play. But there's nothing nefarious going on in there that I'm aware of.
You know, it's a hidden layer in a neural network. All of that sounds like nonsense to somebody outside the field, but a headline that a computer invented its own language could be quite alarming.
Yeah.
Agency in the world would be something that isn't necessary, but would speed things up. Do you mean that from a training perspective, or give me a little bit more insight into your thoughts there?
Yeah. Like the current state of a lot of these models is you have input and desired outputs. And for these language models, you either mask a word or you want, you know, to predict the next word. And it gets feedback on whether or not it gave you the right output. And then it updates, you know, to get closer and closer to the desired output. That's not at all how humans work, right? We don't just get checkbox yes or no, you perform this one task well, you didn't perform this task well. And so I think to speed up the process of having this like generalized intelligence is you need to have these models set up in a way where it's not just inputs and outputs with lots of connections in the middle. Instead, you need them to have the ability to do something besides just give you an output. And you see this in like reinforcement learning and with robots, you can set a goal for the robots. It could be to sumo wrestle another robot, right? And they're going to learn techniques and they'll learn really complex behaviors by just interacting with like another machine or even like another AI. And they can learn lots of things not so explicitly because they actually have agency in the world. Or even in a stimulated world, they have the ability to control themselves. But that requires like someone setting these larger goals for these machines. And I think we kind of skipped a couple steps by feeding these models language, which is like at the top of the pyramid for intelligence to people, right? The ultimate is language. And we skipped all the middle step that regular humans have to go through of how to manipulate objects and how to like move through the world. And I think the reason maybe these things seem so quote unquote intelligent right now is really kind of like a hack because their inputs and outputs are like these complex things of words and sentences.
That's an interesting point. I also want to ask you about reward mechanisms. I think that people can say at the very bottom of it all, it's a dopamine response in the human brain. But even the most unambitious person in the world has multiple reward mechanisms at work. Do you think that that'll play an important role in building artificial general intelligence? Or do you think that once such a system has an array of goals, more or less, that that will be a sign that we've gotten there?
That's a really cool question. So I think humans have these very fundamental goals at first, which are, you know, to be fed and to sleep. And what separates us from other animals is how completely helpless we are and how dependent we are on each other. So our means to obtaining just basic life kind of in the world is communication and eventually language. And so I think if you set up something with this like abstract survival goal where it's dependent on communicating, then it will be able to create more complex behaviors in this like, you know, simulated world where its main goal is to interact with other parts of the simulation or other AI.
I'm not a huge science fiction guy. I've never read Dune, but I've seen reference that in the Dune mythology. There was a big war prior to the events of the book, or including the events of the book. If you're mad about Dune, let me know on Twitter. But there's a rule in their societies that thou shalt not make a machine in the likeness of a human mind. And on the limited reading I did about this, the event that kicks this off is basically something that could have been done by stuff that we're doing right now, or similar to, I don't know, like a credit denial system, but much more extreme. I say all this that at some point between, you know, now and we reach AGI, we're going to hit the most uncanny of valleys. Do you think that we'll be able to push through it? And this is just speculation, but I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
It's just like, as a caveat to this conversation, is that I do applied research. And so all of these are just like super fun things that I'm curious about. And if the AGI of the future is listening, don't be mad. But I would say that it's important to have these discussions sooner rather than later, especially because if you walk down the path of, we might not know when it has this quote unquote, like conscious, like experience type feeling, if we're solely just basing it on its ability to like communicate that with us. Because like you were talking about before with the Turing test, like that's all through deceit, right? Just because Siri tells you that it's conscious doesn't mean that it's conscious. But the flip side of that is like, well, what if something kind of becomes conscious, but we wouldn't know yet because it's not telling us? And so I think not only is it fun to have these conversations because it's such a interesting time in the world, interesting time to be alive, I think we need to have a plan for when we get there, or when we are in that like uncanny valley where, you know, my Roomba does kind of seem like it's experiencing pain and it's having these like complex thoughts, and like, is it wrong or right to unplug it or recharge it if it, you know, is expressing pain? But I don't think we're there yet. I don't think it's, you know, in the next 5 or 10 years. I think we're all going to live a long time, hopefully, and we'll see.
I agree. I worry that for me, it's almost like a horror movie scenario that there would be a machine that, we'll just take an example of a computer that I recently threw out, which was like my Xbox 360. It was old, the hard drive didn't work, and all the discs play on my new Xbox. But I would feel terrible if my Xbox 360 had been a thinking, feeling thing that I essentially starved and had crushed in a trash compactor.
Yeah. I think lots of people are maybe having this feeling, especially as like people have very strong feelings about some of these like chatbots. And, you know, they are, if you have an emotional connection to something, even if it's still on the level of these like deceit machines, does that mean it's wrong or right to destroy it?
We saw when Microsoft had released a pretty good language model for the time several years ago that people just said a bunch of extremely graphic and bad things to it, and the robot learned that and started talking that way. With a child, you try to gatekeep the content it has available to it as it grows. You know, you don't show a kid Stephen King's It when it's like 4 years old. I think that a huge role in whether or not we can survive artificial general intelligence is if we can clean up our corpus of nonsense.
I've been on the internet. It doesn't represent the best of people. There's amazing things, obviously, but using just the vast amounts of literature that we have on the internet, that's reflective, extremely so, in these large language models. I think there's a lot of danger in putting these models in the wrong hands, or not accounting for and documenting what they're trained on, and biases and ethical implications of the training data that you're using. I think it's really common now for models to come with like model card where they explain the drawbacks and limitations and biases in the training data that they're seeing, so you can correlate that back to the model. And I think in the future, the very near future, we need to have a lot more emphasis on curating data sets as a noble effort in research science, and not just scraping all of the internet and using it to train these things. I think having well-curated data sets is really, really important to the ethical implications of all of these language models. And hopefully there's more funding and research going into that.
We're getting towards the end of our time. Are there any topics that I didn't ask you about that you'd like to bring up?
Yeah. So one of the things that I think is really interesting as far as like hot topics in AGI is whether or not you need any symbolic representation of cognitive models in the AGI. So currently, it's very hands-off. The beauty of all of this deep learning is it does the feature engineering for you, right? Once you set up the architecture and you get all your training and your hyperparameters, you're not explicitly telling it what to learn. And obviously, you know, a downside of that is you can make spurious connections and you can have like these adversarial examples where your object detection goes totally awry if there's a couple pixels off or something. And so there's some downsides to that. But the plus side is you don't need to explicitly define how the brain works to use these techniques. But there's some pushback on that that says, if we really want to get to general intelligence, we need to have a hybrid where we're taking into account the knowledge that we do have about cognitive science and neuroscience. And I love this debate. I'm excited about whatever people are fighting about on Twitter in this area, mostly because as someone with a background in cognitive science, we have a wealth of information. We've been studying the human brain for a really long time. And like, how could this not advance this faster if we could apply some of the things that we know? But then the other part of me works at NVIDIA, where we're just this powerhouse of parallel computing and have advanced this field super quickly with just more compute power and using these functional units of quote unquote neurons. And like, don't stand in their way. Like, this is working really well. And if we just maybe set them up with some different architectures, and just like you and I were talking about at the beginning, maybe it's this like diversity of neurons inside these artificial networks. Maybe that's going to get us there faster, of actually just better modeling the architecture of the brain rather than these bigger cognitive concepts like internal models of the environment or emotions or, you know, those types of things.
While you were talking about advances, it struck me there is a question that I don't think gets asked enough that I'll ask you. I think a lot of the people that have laid the groundwork for artificial intelligence and continue to work in it are generally optimists, but an artificial general intelligence may be subject to the things that we don't like about people. To me, it seems that full-blown consciousness entails the risk that it will be given to, we've talked about biases, but fanaticism. At this point, if the machine is conscious, we can talk about poor virtue, whether it's laziness or wrathfulness. So artificial general intelligence, do we want it?
Yeah, that is a loaded question. And I would fall back on my stance that we don't need it to have consciousness to display an intelligence. You know, who knows what the benchmark will be. I feel like it's always moving goalposts for what AGI is. I know one of the definitions is it can walk into any house and make a cup of coffee using a coffee machine, or like enroll in a college course and pass. And I think we can create things in the future that will be able to do those tasks. And I don't think we need maybe all of the downsides of being human that you're describing. I also think, you know, maybe one of the downsides of being human is that we're irrational. I think it would be nice if we had AGI that didn't get super nervous. You know, it doesn't get really sad. I think we can keep those two separate if we're careful. And by we, I mean not me.
Rachel, I think that this is a good place to stop. I really appreciate your time and insight on this topic. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you very much. And hopefully we'll have you back to talk about either this subject or the advances that you're pushing over in cybersecurity.
Great. Thank you so much for having me, Paul. This is really fun to talk about.
Thanks again to Rachel Allen for the delightful discussion of artificial general intelligence. And join us next week for a regular episode where I'm going to sit down with some folks from Blazing SQL. Blazing SQL is a great on-GPU SQL database system, and I hope you join me then. Until then, thanks. Bye.